From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we convene a group of Milwaukeeans who have been closely watching the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Then the balancing act done by a good art exhibit designer.
You don't really want a person to feel like you enhanced. You're trying to make it better. You're just trying to support, again, the narrative that's being told this time with this grouping of works.
Plus, a local festival stresses original local music.
If you want to go see your favorite cover band, there's a lot of festivals in Milwaukee where there's all those great local cover bands. But that's we're doing all original music at our Beat in the Heat.
And the latest installment in our summer series, Listening to Mitchell. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Yesterday on Lake Effect, we talked with two prominent elected officials about the lessons they take from the events of the past couple weeks in Ferguson, Missouri. But around the country, the debate is being driven as much by regular citizens as it is by the people in charge. Despite the fact that these events took place hundreds of miles to the south, when Milwaukee Public Radio put out a call for people to take part in a roundtable conversation, we were inundated with interest, and so we fit as many people as we could into our recording studio. WUWM's Latoya Dennis moderates the conversation with Kenneth Harris, Claire Van Fossen, Amante Gray, Keith Stanley, Tracy Johnson, and Angela Walker.
You can have a majority-minority city, but everyone that works, especially in city government, doesn't look like the people they serve. That makes no sense. It's not the point about no diversity for the diversity's sake. It's the point about Captain Ron Johnson in Ferguson. Captain Ron Johnson Ferguson is a godsend to the town of Ferguson because of one reason. He's black and he grew up there. And that's how Milwaukee can become a Ferguson. If we decide that everyone, our police force, and everyone it happened in Detroit. Everyone lives out the city. They don't look like the people they serve. They come in, do their 8-10 hours, and they leave out. That is a recipe for disaster. Why? It makes no sense. If I could switch this and say, you know what, black people, we're going to go to Brookfield, work in the police department, do everything, and white folks look at us like we crazy. No, this is my town. I'm going to have my father, brothers, in-laws, FBIs, work in these. They wouldn't even think twice about that. But for the city of Milwaukee and a lot of my minority communities, I don't see the problem with it. If people want to be police officers, just sign up. Where there's been 200 plus years of us not being able to, even though we wanted to. It has to be a concerted effort to say, listen, we have to diversify, not because of the sake of diversity, but because we don't want to end up like places like Ferguson. We want brothers and sisters we want minorities, not just brothers and sisters, black brothers and sisters. We want minorities on the force. We want our Latino brothers and sisters to be able to speak to their people on the south side. So that way it calms racial tensions. If people know, as you mentioned, Ken, when you can look at each other and you can connect with each other outside of just being human beings, but hey, he looks like me, he talks like me. I think that's the problem now that we have right now in the city of Milwaukee is that a lot of brothers aren't respecting the cops because he don't. If he looked like my dad, if he looked like my cousin, if he looked like my brother, it'd be a different conversation. You know what, man? He reminds me of my dad, man. I need to go ahead. And plus, there's a way we talk to each other. Right. You know, I can go up to a brother and say, hey, man, come on, what's going on? Okay, man. A white cop from the suburbs, I ain't never dealt with a minority community. They're just asking for trouble when they go up and they kind of, you know, act like they're a rogue cop or a rogue cowboy. It doesn't work that way. I think diversity is important because we want to make sure we don't end up like Ferguson in that point. And it bothers me. I think we're going that direction.
Lessons learned from Ferguson. What can we take?
To realize that racism is still very much so a part of American society and that people need to understand its effects on the black community and not necessarily just accuse black people of having a better wife syndrome, but actually realize and look at what it is and the things that are there. And also, we also have to take another approach and also take a look and reflect on ourselves as black people. What are we doing? Like, what are we what are we really doing to improve our own situation? And part of that is because of racism. It's the reason why we can't pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. It's the solutions to what we face is not just one. we have to pose a hybrid of solutions in different areas, in different pockets of the country, in order to uplift us. And like you were saying, the captain in Ferguson, he looks like the people that live in Ferguson. And if we take that down on a smaller scale and take it to education, where most of our black children, they see white teachers. And that translates into when they get older and they see white cops in front of their faces, like the white teachers they saw in their faces that didn't understand them then, and these white cops that don't understand them now. So, I mean, that's a part of the problem. It's a difficult thing talking about race and what are the solutions and what we can do to bring ourselves up. I say one of the things is that we need to come together as black people, and also that socioeconomic portion of it. If we can just get black, yellow, brown, green people that's poor together and really do something about the establishment that's working against us and really see it, that's kind of almost like keeping us divided in a way of saying like, okay, black people are poor and white people are poor, but we still have this racial difference, so they're not going to team up to get together and galvanize against the establishment. We got Mexicans over here or Hispanic people over here that don't necessarily want to come around black people or don't necessarily want to come around white people, so let's keep them separated and let's not get them to the point where they say, you know, one common thing that we share with each other is the fact that we don't have anything. And if we can get that portion right, I mean, I don't know how to do it. Because that's a huge number, like 98% of the country versus the 1% when you got dealing with money like that. But if we can understand that in different communities around the country and see that our differences aren't really that much, and that our similarities of being poor and not having anything is what needs to bind us, then maybe we can do something.
Time magazine recently ran an article, I don't know if y'all read it, that the next race war is not going to be about race. This is a class war. It is. Race has been long used as a tool, particularly in this country, to keep people who are on the bottom and who are being exploited divided. And it is a very effective tool.
It is.
So, you know, I understand what you're saying, Keith, about, you know, center my community. You can center your community. I am black, first and foremost. I am a black woman. And when I talk about, you know, issues of class and things, I am an intersectional socialist, because for me, race, class, and gender are all, when I walk in the room, all of those walk in the room with me at the same time. I'm not just black, I'm not just a woman, and I'm not just oppressed. I am all three of those things at the same time, all the time. Mm-hmm. So when I approach issues, I am looking at them from the perspective of race, class, and gender. And this is a war on poor people in this country. This is not just started, and it will take, as you are saying, Amante, I center my community because I believe that policies that are good for black folks are good for all folks. As far as everyone needs healthy environment, everyone needs functioning public schools that do what they're needing to do. Everyone needs transit access that is affordable and does what it is supposed to do. Everyone needs living wage work. These are things that unite communities regardless of race. And I can speak to those things centering my community, but they also benefit other communities that we do need to stand together. We are stronger together. And also speaking to residency, if you have people, it isn't just a matter of a person's skin color. I had white teachers that I absolutely loved, that loved me. I had ones that sucked. So, I mean, I'm just going to call it what it is. But, I mean, it's also the mindset that if you are someone that is not invested in the community that you serve, you are not invested, particularly in law enforcement, and invested in and have an understanding of the people that you are serving and see them as yourself. If you are not bringing that mindset with you, when you come in from the suburbs with this us and them mindset, and you are in a position of authority, I'm sorry, you are in a position to abuse that authority, because it is a those people issue. Our folks in the suburbs are not looking at people in the inner city, particularly of Milwaukee, and saying, that's my other me. That's me. I'm not looking at myself. And media is a huge part of that. It is those people.
We have to remember that in Ferguson, we can't use a long-term solution for a short-term problem. You saw last night how many people were rioting. After a week and a couple days, it's maybe like 20 people, 30 people. Okay, well, what happened to the thousands? Well, being human happened. Over time, it's really not that important. But yet the governor calls out the National Guard and we got all this stuff going on. And it's like, really? You're going to use a hammer on a peanut? You know, you use hammers on nails, you know. So there was that disconnect of let them get it out of their system and then let's move to a positive solution. But then we have to remember you can't tear up your neighborhood because that's a long-term problem. Your problem is short-term. The grand jury is not going to be back tomorrow or next week. They don't even have all the evidence. It's not even in. So we're making long-term decisions based on information we don't have. We think we know what happened. Multiple agencies are investigating it. Let them. We don't have any information. You're not. It takes time to do a thorough investigation. And my thing is, if I want a thorough investigation for the man or woman that's accused of shooting the cop, then I want the same thing for the cop that's accused of shooting the man. Because I want the same system to work for both. Because if it don't work for them, it's not going to work for me. Is it a good system? No, but it's the only one we have. And it's the best one in the world. So let's use it to our advantage.
This is how Milwaukee can become Ferguson. Just a couple few points. Politically deaf politicians. If they don't understand how to deal with the African-American community or other minority communities, and specifically the youth, we're setting us up for disaster. You got to have somebody that's connected with the community. Militarization of the police force, it makes no sense to see what some, not the city of Milwaukee, but see what some of the police forces in this country have. And if we don't address that problem, to me it was sad. And I have to admit sometimes my thinking, as you guys probably could tell, is a little more conservative. But to see a whole troop of my white brothers and sisters bearing down guns to some of those brothers and sisters of Ferguson, it was just an ugly picture. So that's the issue. Removal of the residency requirement. Y'all know how I feel about that. I think it's messed up. Hypersegregation in our community is a major issue. It's not for the sake of just the diversity and desegregate. It's the sake of making sure people understand each other and know where they come from and have some sense of community. I think that's important. Outlets for Youth, I mentioned we got some great programs. It's good that we have some great community organizations and other group nonprofits that are doing some things. We have to continue to do that. These youth, if we don't give them an outlet to expand that energy, they're going to be doing the things they did in Ferguson. And then two more things, can't point on it, media. Media is a major issue in this country. We have to deal with something where every time a black man does something, it's just like, oh my goodness. I don't know if my white brothers and sisters have this, but when I watch the news, I say, I hope this wasn't the brother that did this. Yeah. Because it's almost like, man, because they paint, and like I said, it's underlying racism, because once one brother do it, all brothers are associated with it. Oh, you know, black man did this, black man, and that doesn't happen. You just don't hear that. Other communities, it's an individual thing. When a white man does something, it's that particular white man. It's not reflective of the whole entire community. That needs to change. That bothers me. The last thing I want to say is that this is where we take ownership. Absence of black parents. I'm sorry. There's too many black parents that will let the streets raise their children. When I'm coming home at 7, 8 o'clock at night from work and I'm seeing kids that are 5, 6, and 7 and older just hanging out with no direction, how dare we talk about racism and we getting beat up? And then I go to other communities, they dropping their kids off to soccer practice. They taking them to violin lessons. They're involved because they know within a certain time frame that you have to give that child every chance they can get so they can make it in this world. And people, I know some people will say, well, they're working hard, they're doing this. It does not matter. You got with that person to have that child, raise a child. Don't put that responsibility on nobody else.
The issue of the visual, the military being called in, that really caused agitation. And I think Milwaukee, do not do that. You know, and I've seen some of the responses right now from the protests that were happening over the weekend and the rioting that was going over the weekend. And I think it's appropriate. They're saying, let these people riot, let them be peaceful. And I think for the most part, that's the right approach. You know, I think what's happening is that because the riots and the actions and the looting have nothing to do with what actually happened, we're having this negative perception and the media is playing this out. So when I look at the media and I see these people rioting and looting, what am I supposed to think? And I think, what are the other communities supposed to think? They're giving us an excuse to have a negative perception. And perception, unfortunately, becomes reality. And I think that's a huge problem that we can learn from. The other thing that really strikes me is that if we're going to get excited about a white police officer shooting a black man, I think we also need to say, how are we going to get excited when a black person shoots another black person? And let's refocus our energy, not saying we need to riot, but let's focus our energy and let's rally around that. And let's have the same amount of attention paid to that, because it's happening much more often than what we see in Ferguson.
Speaking to black on black crime, I'm just going to put this out there. It is a statistical fact that most crimes are committed between people of the same race. What's happening in inner city neighborhoods is heinous and it's painful, but it isn't any different than what is happening in suburbs with white people victimizing one another. We just get more bad press for it because, hey, black people and naturally inherently criminal. I think that what happened in Ferguson also just highlights the fact that we are not in this country as far advanced in race relations as we need to be. How many unarmed black men were killed the same week that Michael Brown was killed? Mm-hmm. Four. Unarmed. This is not new. This is a pervasive problem from one end of this country to the other. And it is not just black men. It is black women. Ayanna Jones was 7 years old when she was murdered in her sleep by police. We have a problem with the way law enforcement is applied in this country, which is why I say it's not the best system in the world. I understand it's the one we've got, and it's better than a whole lot of.
You're absolutely right.
Lord, we got a lot of room for improvement. Mm-hmm. Take the color blinders off, because it is alive and well here as far as the way that it works in this country. We have got to, and what you were saying about applying equal justice. People in Ferguson are angry for the same reason that anyone who's been following Dontre Hamilton or Corey Stingley or Bo Morrison, we have a problem with black people being seen as inherently violent and criminal, and therefore I am justified in my murder of these people. That is the message, and we have had it. And the black hand that pulls a trigger on a black person is no less culpable than someone white who does it. We live in a very violent culture. And that's one thing that we don't like to talk about. But the whole world looks at us as barbarians because you have to go to Target with an AK-47 strapped to your back. When is that okay? We have a gun problem in this country. We have a problem with violence in this country. And we have a problem with racism in this country. And what you're seeing in Ferguson is the manifestation of all of those things. It will take us to be honest about this country's systemic racism and the way that black people are portrayed in the media and in popular thought, and to say we are all people and embrace our diversities instead of, you know, seeing difference as weakness. And to be able to look at one another and say, yeah, you're not me. You don't come from my community. We don't think the same way, but you're still a person. And I value you as I value myself.
My lessons from Ferguson are systemic racism is alive in the U.S. Within the capitalist system, property is often valued over black life. So there was a lot in the media about looting and rioting and white businesses being broken into. And it was all detraction from the death of Michael Brown. And then just the fact that this is also happening in Milwaukee. When we think about the death of Michael Brown, here in Milwaukee, we've lost Derek Williams, James Perry, Dontre Hamilton. We're under an illusion if we think that this isn't the case in Milwaukee. And I think that outrage is warranted. I agree with Angela that there's a time for rebellion and for outrage, when there's kind of this evidence that we're doing something wrong, it's time to take a hard look at ourselves. And there's not, to me, time or room to try to place blame on the community for what's happening anymore. Not that there ever was, but I'm saying, like, you know, it's past. The evidence is showing us, in my mind, that, you know, we're failing the black community as a city.
WUWM's Latoya Dennis moderated our roundtable on the lessons of Ferguson, Missouri. Our community panel included Kenneth Harris, Claire Van Fossen, Amante Gray, Keith Stanley, Tracy Johnson, and Angela Walker. We'll turn to the world of art next on Lake Effect and find out what it takes to design a world-class exhibit. Keep listening. It's WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Wassily Kandinsky exhibit is entering its final weeks at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The show, which has garnered national attention, was a collaboration between the Art Museum and the Pompidou Center in Paris. The focus of the exhibit is, rightfully, on the art. But who focuses the lights and hangs the paintings and otherwise designs the exhibit so that you can enjoy it? If you think that's the curator's job, you're partially right, but at larger museums, it's also the job of an exhibit designer and his or her staff. David Russick is that person at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and he worked hand in glove with chief curator Brady Roberts and his French counterpart to design the Kandinsky exhibit. Russick and Roberts took Lake Effect's Bonnie North through the exhibit hall, and Roberts begins our tour.
One thing I want you to notice is something that David and I talked about a year ago when we were just conceptualizing this installation. Kandinsky is known basically as an easel painter, so the paintings you see here in the early part of the exhibition, that's what you expect. Right in the middle of this retrospective, of this chronological survey, is the big Bauhaus mural room. So there was an opportunity to do something very theatrical and surprising, and that is have this unfold in a way that you didn't see it coming. And so I want you to look at that as we walk through the exhibition. And also, if you look at these tempera paintings from 1901 to 1906, they have a black background and very bright colors on them. And that's one of the references in the mural room that we'll see.
So, David, from your perspective, as Brady and other curators talk to you about putting exhibits together, what are some of the things you have to think about that we might not be aware of?
Well, I see my job, Bonnie, as picking the brain of the curator, because the average visitor doesn't get to. And the exhibit design can reflect what it is they're thinking. It's great to assemble a list of 60 fantastic paintings or photographs or sculptures, but why those 50? Why Kandinsky? Why that artist? That's the story that the curator tells. And the exhibit design can reinforce that.
So when you sit down and talk to a curator first, what are some of the first questions that you ask?
Where do you want to start? In Kandinsky's case, it's a chronological installation. We start at the beginning and we end with the man's death. It unfolds accordingly, just like anyone's life would in a chronological manner. You know, the sort of thing that Brady just mentioned, where there is this phenomenon of painting on black canvas that's kind of tipping the hat early on in the man's career, and then it's echoed again later. But the fact that we kind of buried the big star, the mural room of the whole thing, that was something we agreed on early.
Yeah, you have to work to get there.
Right.
Absolutely.
And the way we thought about this, we knew that this first section, which is Kandinsky as a student studying Impressionism and German Art Nouveau, Jugendstil, we knew that this would look fairly conventional, and that as you walked through the exhibition, it was going to build up in terms of the sort of dynamism and surprises. And so once you pass through the mural room, it's kind of full of surprises. And, I mean, it becomes more and more sort of engaging and theatrical and never lets up.
Well, and it also reflects his career and what he was doing in art as well. You know, you start with the more conventional and you work toward what he did, was just sort of blow everything out of the water.
Well, you think of the time that he was living and working, and where the drama begins is with the First World War and the Russian Revolution. I mean, there's a huge disruption in Western society, and then he pops out on the other side, and he's in the Bauhaus, which is one of the great art schools of all time. And he's in Dessau working with Moholy Nagy and Marcel Breuer and Paul Klee and Oscar Schlemmer and Lionel Feinger. And it's an incredible period. And he has this brilliant, prolific decade-plus period. And that's amazing. And then you are entering the Nazi period, the rise of Nazism. He leaves Germany and he goes to Paris. And then he sees the buildup for the Second World War. So, I mean, he's living through these epic shifts and junctures in Western history, and a lot of it's reflected in his art until the end, when he really sort of transcends major historical events. But it's a very dramatic period that he lives in.
So when you think about setting up the exhibit, David, obviously one of the things that you think about is how to move people through mm-hmm. so that they are experiencing what Brady just talked mm-hmm. about. And so, you know, are you working with ground plans of, because all of these walls are movable and they change every time there's an exhibit in here. How do you think about moving people and making sure that they at least have an opportunity to get everything that you're trying to have them get?
Well, there's the design that is aesthetic based. You know, how do we make it look beautiful? How do we make it exciting? And then like you're implying, there are just the simple concerns of moving people through. Additional concerns for us is that we don't have light levels that are too high. Obviously, you don't want to look at art in the dark, but a lot of people don't appreciate the fact that a lot of the works can only be lit with so much light, because light is damaging to anything that it strikes, especially works on paper. So those are some of the boring things that we have to deal with, Bonnie. I think the part of what I like to leave as the experience is all the fun stuff that we get to deal with, the colors and the path that you take and how it reflects the story that Brady is trying to tell. But yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things like the heights of pedestals and the turn radiuses for wheelchairs and the evacuation opportunities if there was, you know, some kind of emergency. So yeah, we do a lot of boring stuff too.
But you know, that makes the whole exhibit. I mean, even if you're not aware of it, you still, if you come in here, you experience that, the color of the walls.
Right.
You know, how you physically move through the space and through the art.
Well, and then, like, I'm looking behind you and I realize we're on radio, so it's probably not going to be a very helpful comment, but you know, where the walls that are, as you said, all the interior walls are movable, where do the walls align with color breaks? You know, where behind you the one wall is white and then it breaks to a blue, and that supports the wall that's standing right here and creates a doorway. Things like that are in my mind anyway, really exciting, kind of fun to work with. They can be dramatic, they can simply be directional. And so we work with a model, a half-inch scale, so that if your listeners want to kind of imagine that, a 6-foot man in a half-inch scale is 3 inches tall, so about the size of your pinky. You know, most of the works in a show like this at that scale are about the size of a dime, you know, in a model like that.
So it's like a theatrical model.
It's like we call it the dollhouse. We're not that grand. And we even refer, when we're working on it, we always say, let's go play with the model. I mean, it really is. I think that's part of what we do, not to be too flip about it, but I mean, part of what we do is, you know, we only get to make one installation, and to make it the best one, it's incumbent on us to really keep open mind. One of the real challenges there is on the curator, because the curator is someone who's thought about an exhibit for so long prior to, I mean, even talking to an exhibit designer. For that person, that man or woman, to be fresh and open-minded when they come to the, like, okay, let's lay this beast out, that's so important. And, you know, it doesn't always happen, but when it does, I think the results can be really exciting.
Did you find that it was difficult to think about it in a fresh way, like David said, when you finally got around to placing stuff?
Well, I should say that we had a third partner in this. Angela Lampa is the curator of modern art at the Pompidou, and 90% of this exhibition comes from the Pompidou. So she was a key partner in creating this design. And actually, she had installed a smaller version of this show in Milan before. So she came in the winter and brought us photographs of the installation. And it was great because it's like she had test driven some pretty radical ideas. So the color scheme of this exhibition is something a little bit more radical than I would have done on my own, because when you have a whole gallery that's painted black, you better know what you're doing. And she actually took her cue from Kandinsky, who painted some of his walls in his apartment at the Bauhaus black. And he hung one of the paintings that's in this show on a black wall, and it looked beautiful. And so that was her key, her clue that that could work. And it's really super effective. And you come out of the mural room, which is predominantly black, into the Bauhaus period that's black. And so it's like a signal of this major shift in his career from the Russian period, from the World War I era, to the 1920s, which is a very different time historically and one of this great periods for Kandinsky's output. And then from there, you move into this beautiful light blue airy room of his Paris period. And she again took her cues from him. When he moved to Paris, he wrote a letter to Alfred Barr, the director of the Museum of Modern Art, and said, the diffuse light in Paris is so beautiful. And you see that his palette becomes pastel. So he's responding to the light and air around him, and we in turn respond to that in our exhibition design.
Well, take me to something else that we want to talk
great
about.
Yeah, let's go look at his paintings from 1913, because this will be another piece that is very important to understanding the Bauhaus murals. So this is the great painting from the Bradley Collection, Composition 7. It's the central fragment for one of his major paintings, which is in the Tretiakov Museum in Moscow. And this is a very densely loaded symbolic painting, and it's about a sort of a biblical take on the 20th century, where he's referencing the deluge and the apocalypse and the end of one world and the coming of a world war and the sort of dawn of a new era. So it's very utopian. And this is interesting now in 2014, when we're having all of this analysis about the 100th anniversary of World War I. What we lose sight of is that there were a lot of people before World War I who had no idea what the first industrially mechanized war would mean. Nobody really knew the degree of devastation that would occur. And people were conditioned to having wars that were much smaller. And there was a feeling that a war could be a cleansing event, and that it could be a good thing. And there were people who felt that French society was decadent and that maybe it was time to clean things up and have a good war, be over by Christmas, we move on. I'm not saying that Kandinsky felt that way, but he did have a very utopian view of industrialization and the modern era and what it could bring, and it's expressed in 1913. And that drastically changes in 1914 when he enters into the war period and he goes back to Russia because he has to leave Germany. And Russia, of course, is gearing up for the October Revolution of 1917. So it's basically a time of turmoil in Russia and a very difficult period for Kandinsky and for everyone on the continent and in Russia. So there is this really drastic shift in his art from this really most utopian, energetic apex of Kandinsky's career in 1913.
And looking at it from a design perspective, you know, you've got it on a single blue wall, but you have to come around, you come into it, and then you have to turn around and see it.
Exactly right, Bonnie. So, you know, you come into this space, and it's all sort of this very medium pale gray, like the space behind us, and here's this one standout blue wall. So, you know, again, a lot of what I do is not rocket science. It's more a matter of, again, trying to physically embody something as complex as what Brady just said. And the first thing you have to do is accept that there's no way. You know, just like I say to people a lot of times, you're probably not going to look at that painting and get everything that Brady said. But if you delve into the work, what Brady just said makes perfect sense. And it's like, oh my gosh, no wonder people enjoy art at the level that some do, because there's all these layers. And again, that's the opportunity exhibit design offers, is that you can be another layer of that. You can be another portion of what makes coming and looking at the work so rich. I mean, when I see a checklist like Kandinsky, I jokingly say to the curator, okay, I have an idea. We can just put them on the floor, on blocks, all around the gallery, give everybody a flashlight, and just, I mean, they don't need anything. They don't need me. But you've got an opportunity that you don't really want a person to feel like you enhanced. You're trying to make it better. You're just trying to support, again, the narrative that's being told this time with this grouping of works. That's how I see my job. It's not like I'm going to make Kandinsky better. I'm going to try and help tell the story this grouping of Kandinsky paintings, prints, and drawings are telling this time.
Brady Roberts is chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum and co-curator of the Kandinsky exhibit. David Russick is the museum's exhibit designer. They spoke with Bonnie North. You'll note we did not have time for a complete radio tour, but at wuwm.com/lake effect, the tour picks up where we left off and includes a full discussion of the famous mural room. An event tomorrow in Bayview serves in part as a showcase for local artists and musicians of all kinds. We'll learn about it in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. An art space known as the Hyde House Collective in Bayview will play host to a growing local arts festival tomorrow. Art Beat in the Heat features a variety of local musicians and artists with an aim towards reaching all age groups. The festival is the creation in part of local musician Annie B., who talked with WUWM's Rachel Owens about how it has changed since its inception.
It started out 5 years ago. And it actually, the whole Art Beat thing started out in 2009, so 6 years ago. And the first event was a kind of like a talk show format. And we brought in artists of all different types. And it was kind of like a, you know, Letterman or Jay Leno thing where we interview the artists and then we get to enjoy their art. So we always start, and this is still consistent because we just had an Art Beat event. It's the thing that we do during the fall and the spring. We try and have one every fall and every spring. Sometimes we have one, sometimes we don't. But we usually have at least one of these shows every year. We did have one this spring. And we interview the artists and then we get to enjoy their art. And so we always start with a spoken word artist. And they actually open up the show with a spoken word piece, which is really, really, really powerful. Have you ever gone to see any spoken word?
Well, yes, not here in Milwaukee yet.
It's so powerful.
It is.
It's so amazing. And so that's a great way to open up the show. So we do that and then we interview the artists and we talk about what, you know, where do they get their inspirations and, you know, how they talk about a lot of the artists sometimes will talk about how it changed their life, you know, really being able to pursue this art form. And then we do a visual artist. We do a slideshow, and we've got a gallery of their art. Actually, we open up the space like 2 hours early just for the gallery. We got this gallery of maybe 10 to 15 or 18 artists, sometimes not that many, but depends on the space. So we start out with the gallery, then we start the show, and the second artist is always the featured visual artist, and so we get to talk about their art. And then the third artist is always a unique, something different, like a filmmaker, actor, dancer, you know, somebody that's doing another form of art, performance art. I mean, you never know. We might have a chef. You know, I mean, that's an art form. I think being a really good chef is definitely an art form. Being able to create a really good dish.
Yeah, I certainly agree.
Yeah. So, and then we always close those shows with the musical act. So it's like a little 2-hour show. And this was the original idea behind putting on events in Milwaukee. And then in 2010, I was like, we got to have a festival during the summer. We can't make it an indoor show. It's got to be a festival. Mm-hmm. And so the first year we had at the Hyde House, we've been doing it at the Hyde House every year, which is in Bayview, which is a huge artist community. Do you know about the Hyde House?
No, not really, actually.
Oh, well, they have artist spaces that you can rent. And so there's a lot of visual artists that have their – that's where their studio is, at the Hyde House. Mm. And that's where Bubbler Studios is. Mm-hmm. And they put on their own events too. So Amanda and Ryan do a lot of different events at Bubbler Studios. And actually the Bubbler Studios space is the backstage area for Art Beat and the Heat, because it happens to be on the loading dock. And that's right behind there is their space. So that's kind of how it started. The idea behind it was this is an art show. We want to have original music. We want to have artists that are showing off their original work. So the goal is, you know, we want all the bands to play all their own original music. And there's plenty of festivals. If you want to go see your favorite cover band, there's a lot of festivals in Milwaukee where there's all those great local cover bands that you can enjoy. But that's – we're doing all original music at Art Beat and the Heat. And it's about the art. It's not, you know, just about the festival and the fun. It's about sharing, you know, people's art and enjoying original stuff. And that's the artist vendors, obviously. They're visual and artists and craftspeople with their – because we have about – maybe 20 or 30 vendors this year too. So,
and as you said, there's a lot of competition for festivals in the summertime, a lot of free entertainment, and a lot of them are geared for just have a good time, and there's nothing wrong with that. So how do you kind of put a spotlight on what you're doing?
That's – I would like to think that, you know, that is what makes us unique, is that you're going to go – you're going to come to this festival, and maybe you've heard of these bands before, maybe you haven't, but you're going to hear some really great local music created by artists, musicians right here in Milwaukee. It puts a spotlight on the great art that we have going on here. You know, the artist vendors, the music. We've got a spoken word artist, too, that's going to be I think they're going to be doing some stuff right at the beginning of the day. And they might – we'll see if they're going to do some more stuff a little bit later on in the day too. So,
Do you see a lot of these different artists from different genres, if you will, kind of collaborating after the fact?
Sometimes. It's hard to keep track of everybody.
So. Yeah.
But it is definitely a community that it exists in Milwaukee. And there's a lot of communities, art communities that exist, and hopefully – Art Beat and Milwaukee Art Beat and Art Beat in the Heat is something that does connect artists that maybe never thought about working together before. And then they finally got to see the other artist because they happen to be playing, you know, right before them or right after them. And they're like, hey, you know, let's do something together or whatever.
Mm. Is it kind of cool to see the overlap of different scenes, like the music scene versus overlapping with the visual scene, maybe kind of different views of the city that people don't normally see juxtaposed one against the other?
I think so, yeah. I think that the collaborative aspect of what's happening in Milwaukee has really come, you know, it just keeps growing and growing. And there's other events. You know, you go to Gallery Night and they have a musician there. And you go to other events and it's always – you can always enjoy other – art forms, and it's really cool.
So yeah, you've talked about, you know, that this is definitely picking up steam, and that's great, the Art Beat and the Heat event. But how difficult is it for a small group of people with almost no publicity and no budget to put on something like this?
I mean, we're really relying on the community that's been created so far and the communities that are connected to this group of people, like Bubbler Studios, the Hyde House, Cafe Central has posters up inside the restaurant. sky high. You know, they're talking about it. Milwaukee Alt is Ryan. He's also got his own thing going, and he's talking about it with his group of people over there. And then the Groundwork Milwaukee is also a sponsor, and they're doing what they can to get the word out. So it's kind of really grassroots stuff, and every single band, you know, we're relying on them to tell their friends about it. And Nick Ramsey and I were the first. We kind of created the original shows together. He and I used to co-host the shows and interview the artists. So Nick's got his own community that he brings in because he's down in Racine. Mm. And so he brings his Racine people up, and it is a very collaborative thing, too, to get the word out.
The musical lineup as well is pretty impressive. And including this year, you have one of the hottest bands in the area. You have the Kane Place Record Club playing.
So excited about Kane Place Record Club and Fresh Cut Collective, the Max and the Invaders, and Chicago's Maya and the Bear. Mm. We have an artist, too, that just got added to the lineup, BJ Fisher. So that is going to be – I think that's the first opening act. And then, of course, Family Power Music, which is Nick Ramsey, and that whole group of people. They used to do an open mic. They used to do one at the Miramar, and they used to do one at UWM. Maybe they still do the one at UWM. But The Quiet Time, too, it's – have you seen The Quiet Time?
No.
Oh, they're great. It's really, really cool, the lineup. I'm so excited. And – my band is playing throughout a little bit later in the afternoon. So it'll be fun, and a variety, too, a variety of styles of music. So
Yeah, you mentioned your band, and you've recently changed the name of your band. Is that right?
Yeah, it used to be Annie B and the Vagabond Company, and now it's Annie B and the Complication, just to keep it complicated, I guess.
Wonderful. Well, Annie B, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about this awesome event.
Thanks for having giving me the opportunity to share the event with the listeners of WUWM at night.
Our pleasure.
Musician Annie B is the CEO and founder of Artbeat in the Heat, an art and music festival happening all day tomorrow at the Hyde House on Greeley Street in Bayview. She spoke with WUWM's Rachel Owens. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent work is Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here is this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street 7 blocks from the Majeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we are sharing the voices and the sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
I had my first on Mitchell.
First thing is rice and spice.
When we went to go get my first bra, like the whole family went.
I remember what I was wearing. I had on a white shirt with my little capri jeans.
That was where I got my first, you know, nylons, and they also had garter belts.
Harley's. I was Harley's first employee.
Wow.
And I got out of high school in 48. I was there for 2 years, and then I got drafted.
We missed the bus, and I said, well, we're going to be marked absent anyway. We might as well not go, you know. We came to Mitchell Street to go shopping. You know, it was like I was about 15 or 14, and it was like, okay, I'm going to buy a bikini. First bikini. Mom and Dad aren't going to like this. Well, I think I wore it once. Yellow.
Polka dots?
Yes, of course. The song, you know.
I have actually a lot of firsts that happened on Mitchell Street. I actually spent my first cash on Mitchell Street to buy some clothes for myself. I had my first haircut on Mitchell Street. Went to a Chinese restaurant for the first time on Mitchell Street. At the Majeska Theater. I don't think I ever told her this, but my first kiss was there. Well, okay, it was out of a dare, actually, because she's the one that set it up. She said, okay, we're going to meet. He's going to be at the theater. You know, he's looking around, and, she sent me over there and she dared me. I took her up on it. But she made me do it. And I did. I don't know why.
Listening to Mitchell is on Mitchell Street from the Modjeska to St. Stan's until the end of September. Guides to the installation are available at businesses on Mitchell Street and throughout the city. There's more information at listeningtomitchell.org. That's another week's worth of Lake Effects. We are produced by the team of Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and yours truly, along with Eleanor Peterson, Brooke Dowden, and Audrey Nowakowski. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. We get web support from Michelle Maternowski and lots of support from all of you who listen each and every day and who will hopefully tune in again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Coming your way at noon, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now it's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.